Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Take a look at solar farms in the state. The proliferation of solar farms on our rural Wisconsin landscape. You know what? It's been welcomed by a lot of people, but it's been criticized by others. And our guests today are looking into how solar power can be generated while at the same time preserving our farmland. And a couple of guests for you. Stephen Lohide is a hydrologist and professor of civil and environmental engineering at the UW-Madison. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Larry. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great to have you with us as well. Encore Desai is our other guest today, the department chair and professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences in the UW-Madison College of Letters and Sciences. He's our weather guys that we have on from once in a while. He's the a colleague of those two fellows. And Encore, welcome to you.
Yeah. Thanks, Larry. Thanks for having me on a lovely day with a little bit of a light dusting of snow.
It's great to have you both with us. And as we talk with these two experts, I hope you'll join in with your questions. The field is called agrivoltaics, and we're going to get some more about that. But what do you think about the solar arrays that you're seeing these days? One's right across the road from my sister's, our family home. And it was the old Hanson farm. It's now a solar array. So we've got some firsthand experience, I could say, with a solar array. I've been pretty positive. But what about you? What are your thoughts? The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. And Steve, let's turn to you first. Your focus is agrivoltaics. What is that exactly?
Yeah, well, you know, the idea is really pretty simple. Trying to get double duty out of the land, putting up photovoltaic arrays, which, you know, you've mentioned, you see more of them now. You know, before you might have seen a solar panel or two on someone's rooftop, but now you're starting to see big arrays kind of across different parts of the landscape. And so we're looking at, can you also get some agricultural productivity out of these lands, grow something, graze something between the rows, underneath the rows of panels?
And Encore, how did you get involved in this?
Yeah, this is a great question. I'm a climate scientist. A lot of my work is trying to understand how landscapes and ecosystems are influence and impact climate and how things like future climate change might impact their systems. I've worked with Steve on and off on a couple of projects, and it was we had this opportunity through the University of Wisconsin Research Forward and with the development of this Kagansa solar array to be able to conduct a study where we can directly look at the impacts of growing solar fields in farm areas for their ecosystem impacts and how they affect everything from the water cycle and the carbon cycle and plants and pollinators. You know, we're going to see more of these as we continue into the future. Already, about 5% of our world's energy is produced by solar power, and that's likely to quadruple in the next decade. And we understand, right, what we need for this country is to have both food and energy security. And agrivoltaics is one of the ways that we could consider looking at that into the future.
Let's talk about that research farm that Encore mentioned. Steve, maybe you can start with that. Tell us the background on that.
Yeah, so University of Wisconsin has a lot of sustainability goals. And one of those is net zero by 2050. Mm-hmm. And actually, even more so, by 2030, only 5 years out having all of our electricity production offset by renewable sources. And so the university has solar on some of the rooftops, for instance, at the UW Arboretum, just across the road here at Gordon Commons, but also leases some land out and supports that. So that's what's happening here at the Kagansa site, mm-hmm. is there's land that the university has owned right near the physical sciences lab that produces equipment for researchers. But the land next to it's been rented out as farmland. So now we're going to have a solar field there that is going to be used both to produce power that's going to go into the grid and support our energy goals, but also be used as a research facility, a sort of living lab. This has been really, you know, the Office of Sustainability yeah. has had this as part of their agenda. And we thought, what a better way to sure. produce renewable energy, clean energy, and also learn from it.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. How big is that operation that you're working on? Is it, what, 30, 40 acres or something?
Oh,
like
no,
that?
No. It's a much smaller facility than that. The energy production at that site, let me see, I wrote that down. It's going to be just a couple of megawatts, and it's about 13 acres.
Yeah.
About 13?
Yeah, it's about 14 or 15 acres. And so, yeah, that 2.25 megawatts or so is enough to power like 500 homes. The idea here isn't that this is a particularly large solar farm, but it is kind of typical of some of the agrivoltaics fields we've seen around the state. And in particular, as a research site where we can kind of bring in instrumentation to be able to monitor the climate, monitor the ecosystems.
Yeah.
One of the things that's really special about it is that we're going to have different setups for the panels that we have. So there are, you know, two kind of main types of arrays that people have. One of them is a fixed tilt. And so we live in the northern hemisphere, and the sun is kind of in the southern field of view. And so we have panels that always face to the south. And the sun rises in the east, sets in the west, but the panel is always looking towards the south. Those are, you know, what you saw in most arrays that were developed 10 years ago would have been fixed tilt. Now there's a second variety that's really, really becoming very common, especially at large scale, utility scale solar arrays. And those are single axis trackers. And so instead of facing south, the rows actually run north-south. And mm-hmm. so the panels tilt towards the east when the sun rises, and then follows it through the day and faces to the west by sunset.
Yeah, that's what we have out by Cottage Grove at the farm across the street from our from the home. They tilt throughout, follow the sun throughout the day.
Kind of like a sunflower.
You know, Gus in Altoona has a question that kind of relates to that. Gus, hi. Gus, are you there?
Hello?
Hi, go ahead, Gus.
Yeah, I was just looking on the Rutgers site because they have their campus all covered, their parking lots covered with solar panels, and they're looking at to put solar panel fences up so that the cattle can graze in between them. And they have bifacial panels so that in the when the sun comes up in the east, you get a lot of energy right away. When it's noon, you don't get hardly anything because the sun's straight up. But then in the evening, you get more sun, too. So it kind of fills in, you know, that that use of people needing energy in the morning and at night more than that. And you can still use the fields. So I thought that was pretty interesting research project that they've just started in the last year or so.
Yeah,
that's awesome. You bring up some really good points. Those are really neat systems. They have some of those in Germany too. But yeah, the idea is that essentially the panels are vertical. Mm-hmm. And so they're just like fences. And so you can much, much more easily imagine a combine going between rows of solar panels that are in that orientation. Right. But the other good point that was really raised there is that when you're producing more of the energy is in the morning when people are getting ready mm-hmm. and need it, then midday, right, the panel's not receiving direct radiation. So you have a little bit less production there, but then it again ramps up at night when people are using more energy. So there's some better timing in terms of the production of the energy matching with people's use.
Yeah, I have to say, both Steve and I were at a conference last week in Washington, D.C. with a lot of climate scientists, including an entire session on agrivoltaics. And one of the things that was just remarkable is the range of creativity. I mean, the nice thing about a solar panel is that it's a relatively simple device when you think about it. And you can use it in a lot of different ways. And so whether a vertical panel, because it can work better on a farm, versus a parking lot panel that might be on top and kind of provide some shade, versus some of the things we're working on here where we want to have a little bit greater row spacing so that you could have planting or grazing in addition to having being able to maximize power generation.
Vern in Eau Claire County will give you a chance to join in too. Hi, Vern.
Oh, hi. Good morning. Thanks for letting me on. So on your solar panels, they're not practical. They never will be. For one, you get DC power. Take complex electrical systems to convert to AC, and it's really not AC, it's a clipped pulse, whatever you want to call it. And, you know, you got this big solar farm. You know how much energy a battery stores? You couldn't store enough energy you want to. And you can't have, you got to maintain, you're going to connect to the grid.
All right. So Vern's not in favor of solar at all from the sound of it, Steve.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Vern has some points here. One of the main challenges with solar getting to very high percentages is being able to store it. People want to have energy, not just in the day when the sun's out, but at night, and they want to have energy in the winter, right? And so getting to very high percentages of solar is going to be challenging until we get better battery systems available. But right now, there are lots of other sources that you can turn down the production at other facilities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you kind of balance that throughout the day.
Pam in Whitewater will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Pam.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I live in Whitewater. We are getting a solar farm. It's going to be about 2,000 acres. And some of our local residents are pushing back on it because they are going to be surrounding our homes, that kind of thing, and we don't like it. And I hear a lot about the impact on the environment, the impact on the water, the impact on other things, but I never hear anything about the impact on the people who are being surrounded by these. You know, I'm going to go from a farm field on three sides of me to solar fields on three sides of me. And I feel like I'm getting moved into an industrial park. And I'm also concerned about the long-term changes. I mean, you're talking about grazing underneath and that kind of thing. And I like that idea. But the solar panels that are being put in now are going to be 8 feet off the ground, and they're going to be close enough together. And I wonder how they're going to be able to change those things as the solar things are updated.
Oh, the panels and so forth. All right. Well, what do you think, Encore?
I mean, these are important points, right? Not every, with both of the last two callers, solar is not the right solution everywhere. And thinking about not just the impacts to the local system where you're installing the panels, but also the view shed, right? And so, for example, at the Kagansa Array that we were talking about earlier, where we're partnering with Alliant Energy, a lot of the focus was also about thinking about the view and putting in additional buffers to make sure that those who want to protect what they see, as well as to kind of think about where solar panels are sited appropriately and correctly, because the impacts are not just to ecosystems and animals, but also to individuals. But that said, there is, of course, right, about two-thirds of the current U.S., the last year's U.S. New energy generation was solar. It is the fastest growing energy source in the country because it is one of the cheapest sources of energy in the country. And so we do have to get our heads around the fact that it is going to be a major part of our global energy system. And we need to think carefully about where we put these systems.
Yeah. Steve, anything to add there?
Yeah, no, the change to the viewscape is really is a real one, right? And you can do a lot with where you place it, putting it a little bit lower in the landscape, putting some tree lines to minimize the impact of neighbors. But, you know, when one comes in, often it's an individual farmer who's deciding that they want to lease out their land for often a 30-year period. And instead of farm it actively, they'll be generating some revenue through that lease. And some farmers see that as a way to rest the land and recover it and allow, you know, organic matter to build up in the soil and have the idea that, okay, I'm going to use it for solar generation for 30 years, but then I'm going to go back into farming.
Mm-hmm. Lots of interesting points here already, and we have other callers online. But I really do want to get into the nuts and bolts of your research, too, because I'm really interested in the research that you're doing on things like the drip line. I mean, you know, when water's hitting those panels, they're all coming down. If it's sort of like your house without a, if you have a house that is getting a lot of water, you might wind up with a drip line along the house. Well, that same thing could happen with solar. And I know you're researching that, and we'll get to that. Just a reminder, though, that our guests today are, Steve Lohide, hydrologist and professor of civil and environmental engineering at UW-Madison, and Ankur Desai, who is the department chair and professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences. And they're working on this research project to kind of look at what are some of the impacts of a solar array on the land. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're taking a look at agrivoltaic research and how crops can be cultivated under solar farms. And a couple of guests for you, Steve Lohide from the UW-Madison, a hydrologist, professor of civil and environmental engineering, Ankur Desai is the department chair of the Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences Department. So it's great to have both of them with us. They're combining on a research project looking into this. And you can join in with your own questions at 800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Before we go back to the phones, let's go to Stella in Sturgeon Bay, I think. Stella, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you. I've had a number of thoughts about solar panels in fields. One is somebody mentioned solar panels being mounted 8 feet high. If they're 8 feet high and if they're on these single trackers mounted on a north-south orientation and they rotate from east to west, if they are in a field that is planted with perennial forage for grazing animals, it should certainly be possible to have animals grazing under them while enough sun should get through to nourish the grasses. And it certainly, with climate change, it getting hotter and hotter every summer, shade for the animals would be very much appreciated. And another thought is if the panels are mounted lower than that and animals can't get under it, ginseng is a really important crop in Wisconsin, and it requires shade. So could that be a potential possibility, planting ginseng under solar panels?
Hmm.
Absolutely. These are both fantastic ideas. Yeah, so the mounting of the panels, when you talk about the height, that's the height at the central axis. So when it's tilted, one edge is lower than that. But certainly there is plenty of room underneath a standard solar array for animals to graze underneath it. And there is evidence that sheep that do graze do spend their time when it's sunnier underneath in the shade. Certainly heat stress is one of the factors that can reduce your meat production if you're grazing. So absolutely, that's a important consideration for agrivoltaics. Thinking about the height of the vegetation is also an important criteria when you're planning a site. If you're planning it with native pollinator habitat, for example, that's considered a form of agrivoltaics because those increased pollinators help improve productivity in surrounding fields. But you do need to make sure that the native vegetation that you're planting is not going to be tall enough that it'll provide some shade in the early hours of the morning or the late evening hours.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Ankur, you were going to add something there?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, one of the original use cases for agrivoltaics actually came out in the desert Southwest, where there was a very quick realization that there's plenty of shade-tolerant crops that do a lot better underneath some of these agrivoltaic systems. And in fact, they use a lot less water. And that's one of the things that we want to look at with our particular site, is that while in desert Southwest regions and semi-arid locations, using less water on average is a net good, that can have other consequences in places like Wisconsin, where we're already wet, and that has impacts on things like the local water table.
Yeah, so how are you studying, talk about what you're looking at in your study project on your fields.
Yeah. Go ahead. Well, go ahead.
Ankur, you start.
Yeah, I'll start. with our project that we currently have, we have three of us as investigators, myself, Steve Lohide here on the show, along with Professor Chris Kusharik, who's in agroecosystem science. And the three of us each are kind of approaching this research from a couple of different angles related to our areas of expertise. So I'll let Steve talk about his, but my area of expertise is really understanding how entire fields or forests or wetlands exchange things like greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide, methane, which tell us how productive a land is, tells us how much decomposition is happening on the land. And the way we do that is this really cool technology that I've been working with for the last 20 years, where we take towers and we put instruments on the top of the tower where we directly measure something called atmospheric turbulence, or the winds that move air up and down. Mm. So you've seen gusty days and you see leaves that circle around as the air moves around them. Well, that air isn't moving more than just leaves. It's actually also moving the gases like water, like carbon dioxide, that leave or enter plants and then enter or leave the atmosphere. And so we measure that 20 times a second on top of a tower, in this case, over the solar array. And from that, we can back out how much productivity is happening underneath this array, how much water we're losing over the entire system as a whole. And so with our current experiment, we have two. I was just out there yesterday mucking my way through the mud as they were building the site. And I think we're going to put one of these towers in the middle of the array. And we're going to put basically one in a field that's more of a typical rotation crop, where we'll be able to kind of compare and contrast the change in productivity and the change in evaporation that we'll see over this site.
That's pretty cool. Steve, what are you up to?
Yeah, well, when you start talking about the hydrologic response, that's when I get interested. And so, you know, the thing that I studied, and if you think about it, even before you have a solar panel, right, it's the movement of water across and through the landscape. And so precipitation falls, you have a rainstorm. Most of that's going to infiltrate into the soil. If it's an intense rainstorm or lasts long enough, you might have some start to accumulate on the land surface and then run off. And that's what would cause flooding or storm response. It's eventually going to reach the streams and create flooding issues potentially. But most of it enters the soil. And once it's in the soil, then the plant roots take it up and use it for evapotranspiration. In Wisconsin, rough numbers, 2/3 of the precipitation that we get is returned to the atmosphere through evapotranspiration.
Oh, didn't know that.
yeah, it's surprising for a lot of people.
So how are you? So what are you actually doing there as part of the study? I mean, how are you figuring out this business?
We're monitoring the soil moisture, and that changes when you have a solar array in two predominant ways. One, you have the panels themselves. So rain hits the panel and then ends up focused at the drip line. So you have a lot more rain landing in a pretty small area. And you're going to have wetter soils there, potentially that water moving deeper in, maybe even replenishing our groundwater systems. The other major effect that we see at solar arrays is that the plants are in the shade a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Say they don't receive as much energy to drive that evaporation, that evapotranspiration of water. It takes a lot of energy to change water in from the liquid phase to the vapor phase. We know that when we sweat, we cool off. It's because it's requiring some energy for that process. And the plants aren't getting as much when they're in the shade. So that means that water has to go somewhere. Maybe it becomes that surface water runoff, or maybe it becomes groundwater recharge.
So, and that's what you're looking at. How much of it is recharge and how much is going straight down?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's take some, we got callers online with questions. Dick in Black River Falls will go to you, then we'll get to Andy in La Crosse. But Dick, what's on your mind?
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, I just loved hearing what Steve had to say there. It's so positive. And my comment is to the people who think that it's so obscene to see windmills and that kind of thing, solar panels on roofs. My take on it is, you know, way back in the 30s when the power poles came in across the country, people had to change and adapt to that then. And now we see huge power poles right in our communities. We can't drive through a town without seeing huge power lines. And how obscene is that? And yet we accept it. You say, oh, that's the power. We got to have it. And I just think that the windmills are such a positive thing to see, getting free energy. And we have all these people who are trying to do it right. So I'm 77. Change is hard for all of us. But it's such a beautiful thing to know that it's a positive change. That's my only comment.
Oh, Dick, thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Encore, you just want to make a comment on that?
Yeah, I appreciate your point. This is part of our research goal as well, which is broadly there is the ability to develop tools that can help us understand where it is appropriate to site renewable energy sources from a variety of considerations for the environment, for local communities, for agriculture. And in fact, for example, I work some with the Nature Conservancy, which has been developing a site renewables right tool that's focused on the conservation aspects and where renewable energy installation would have the most benefit, but also the most protection of the environment for where they go in.
Thank you again, Steve. Appreciate that call. Andy in La Crosse will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Andy.
Hi. Yeah, I guess I have a question about, and I don't know all the logistics behind setting the solar panels up, and it really doesn't pertain to what your guests with their water runoff stuff, but is there a reason why we don't utilize, like, parking lots and such that seem to be such open spaces, and it would, like, you know, shade the lots so they don't get so hot, but maybe it's a height issue or something with that.
Okay, solar panels on parking lots. Mm-hmm. Steve?
Yeah, no, that is being done in a fair number of places. I worked for a year at the Desert Research Institute, and there were solar panels there over the parking lot, and it was kind of nice to be able to park your car in the shade if mm-hmm. you live in Nevada. In Wisconsin, we have some more considerations with snow and snow loading above the cars that are parking under it. But there's certainly some potential there to have more solar over parking lots and also on buildings.
And there are, Joel was just reminding me, there are solar arrays over parking lots on the Epic campus in Verona.
That's right. That's right. And like, when it comes to solar, you kind of have to think about the kind of three main ways that we think about solar installations and power, right? There's residential solar, putting solar panels on your house, generating power locally, maybe selling some back to the grid, and that provides a power for maybe one home. And then there's commercial grade solar. So these are the things where an individual company or a group wants to put solar panels, say, over a parking lot. And that provides power potentially for being able to offset some of the energy use. But really, with those things don't have the scale to, say, go up to something like utility-scale solar, where really what we want to do is be able to generate power for hundreds or thousands or hundreds of thousands of homes and communities. And that's really where some of the agrivoltaics kind of provides a potential solution beyond kind of having very, very large solar arrays that use up land and solely for solar.
Yeah. And there are solar farms in, I think, Fitchburg and Cashton and Fond du Lac. where they have sheep grazing with them. I don't know if you're familiar with those, but I would think there'd be some environmental benefits to solar grazing, I guess you'd call it, Steve.
Yeah. Solar grazing is definitely one of the really big hot topics that people are thinking about. There was a study out of Oregon that showed that growing forage underneath solar panels in their climate actually ended up producing more and higher quality forage than if you were just growing it in an open field. And the reason for that was in that climate, it's pretty dry summers. And so the reduced evapotranspiration for vegetation underneath the panels during the summer allowed the growing season essentially to last longer out there, right? They didn't run out of water, so the plants kept growing. So, there's been a big move towards that. And in Wisconsin, there are several places that we have grazing underneath panels. And the ranchers who are engaging in this follow kind of a spectrum of different business models, from having an array that they have their sheep at. Yep. And they, you know, have fences between the different rows so that it's small allotment and they can mob graze the sheep. They go there for a short time, then move on to the next one. And after you do that with the grass, then the grasses grow back and recover pretty quickly. So you can get a lot of productivity off of a, you know, relatively modest sized piece of land.
And I did, I saw a piece, an article somebody wrote on one of the sheep farmers, and he said the sheep like it. They can get in the shade if they want to and lay down, and they might rub against it a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. And so they like it. And the other way that the sheep ranchers are making a living is not only raising the sheep, but also getting paid for vegetation management. So usually at these solar arrays, you have to bring in someone to mow the grass, take care of the weeds, keep it up. In dry environments, you worry about dry grasses and fire risk associated. So there's vegetation management needs that the sheep are actually providing. And so some of those farmers are taking their sheep from one array to the next and performing that vegetation management survey. Service.
I know the one guy had thought about, he had sheep, but he had thought about beef, but then learned about the sheep. And so, I mean, are there other animals that might work?
Yeah, that's a great question. So sheep kind of has been the sweet spot. Yeah. The goats.
No goats.
People are worried about the goats are curious. And so they like to chew things, rub at things. And so people are very skeptical of putting goats on. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's why people prefer sheep. But there is a big push for cattle as well. And in fact, there's this lasso competition right now, Large Animal Solar System Operations. It's an America-made challenge. And it's the idea of getting cattle grazing integrated with solar arrays. The concern being that cattle are a much larger animal. Yeah. And so they can rub up against and potentially damage some of the equipment.
Yeah, you got an 800-pound animal leaning up against your solar array. You probably don't want that.
Yeah. That's going to take some engineering challenges for sure.
And some height issues. Yeah. I would guess that those would be higher. The poles would be higher, so they'd be further up.
So that is I mentioned that we had the south facing at the Kaganza site. We'll have the south facing panels. We'll have the single axis trackers, but then we'll also have a set of high elevated fixed panels. Okay. And so those will be high enough that, you know, people could garden underneath without worrying about hitting their head.
Okay, so at least 6 feet, 8 feet maybe.
Yeah. So you can think about that maybe being for like something like, a farmer's market producer who might grow crops integrated within an array.
Yeah, I was thinking about vegetables. Could you do vegetable farmers? Could that work?
Yeah, absolutely. There's as we were just talking about, some of these higher elevated arrays can kind of work well where you need folks working on the ground with vegetables and not having to have the panels in the way. As I've learned very directly, solar panels don't feel good when you hit your head on them. There's definitely some ways that you can kind of work around with different designs to be able to have vegetable production. At the Kagansa Array, yes, as Steve mentioned, there's this one area with elevated panels. And part of that is also for education, in that we can have people come and walk through and underneath. The goal of this array is not just a research farm, but also to be a demonstration site where as the site gets into full hour operation, individuals and groups can come out, meet with some of the team members, learn a little bit more about what would it take to be able to do agrivoltaics on their own operations, or just to learn generally about the energy industry and some of the partnerships that we have with Alliant Energy and other energy companies like Madison Gas and Electric.
Somebody else was wondering in an email, how would llamas or emus do on solar farms?
Yeah,
I have no idea, but they're not like goats, I don't think.
Yeah, something to look into. I've heard it. I've heard that suggested too, and also chickens.
Yeah, why not with chickens?
Yeah.
I can see that as an issue. Well, we're talking about solar here and some research that's being done on the UW by UW researchers, Steve Lohide and Ankur Desai, two of many others who are working on this, relating to having solar and crops in the same spot. You can join in, too, with your questions or comments. We've got some emails. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can phone. So open lines get you on pretty quickly with your thoughts on solar at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Big thanks to everybody who donated during our year-end member drive. It's support from people like, Bruna in Platteville, or Jolene in Chippewa Falls, or Nancy in Tomahawk, among others who contributed during our year-end member drive. And if you missed joining in, still time to do it at WPR.org. I got some of those wool socks when I added to my contributions. When you do this, even still now, you can get those socks if you're willing to contribute $15 a month or more, and you'll be playing an important role in keeping us informed, inspired, and connected. And, of course, thanks for your participation. Right now, talking with Stephen Lohide, a hydrologist and professor of civil and environmental engineering at UW, and Ankur Desai, who is department chair and professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison. Great to have both of them with us. They're combining with another researcher on looking at solar panels and how crops might be cultivated under solar farms. They're looking at water and the atmospheric conditions that may be created around solar panels. Join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. Rolf and Hayward emailed to say, well, you can live near big open spaces like a farm field or solar farm. It may be not always a choice, but farm fields often become massive housing or industrial developments. Which would you rather have access to? So there's a comment from Rolf. And Brad emailed to ask if you have looked at alternative sightings of solar arrays, such as over highways, possibly reducing snow plowing or reducing glare on sunny days. Any of that work being done that you know of, Stephen?
Yeah, there is work. We're not working on that exactly, but there is work being done on that. You know, for instance, one of the ideas is for like irrigation canals. Putting the panels over the canals or over sections of streams so that the water doesn't heat up. Because if that water is returned to a natural stream and it's at an elevated temperature, it's really bad for the aquatic ecosystems and the fish. And so thinking about that, photovoltaics is another term that's out there, putting them on lakes or on the ocean where, you know, they might not be as visible to folks.
Amy in Cumberland has a question. Amy, hi.
Hi. My question is, instead of putting all the solar panels and fields in on acres, why wouldn't, being that most of them are subsidized or paid for by the government, why wouldn't we put one on every house rooftop?
All right. Why wouldn't we put one on every house? Well, there's some houses that, mine, for example, where I can't because of the trees.
Right.
That's the same for mine, actually. I tried, yeah. But I have too much shade. We live in an old neighborhood with really well-established trees, and so we get a lot of shade. That's one thing. But residential solar is certainly a piece of the puzzle, right. And there is a lot of growth in that industry as well. You do have to connect it to the grid still. So, you have to integrate the solar that you're producing with the electricity that you're going to get so that you have power at night.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, there's definitely a lot of benefit for rooftop solar. And there are programs to be able to have evaluate your home, to be able to look at things like resources from Renew Wisconsin and elsewhere. But when it comes to just broadly thinking about this energy transition and being able to have homegrown energy grown here in the United States, we have to look at all possible options of where we can have energy produced.
Amy, thanks again. Ethan in Madison, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Ethan.
Hello, my name is Ethan Kellock. I'm a senior undergraduate student in the AOS department at UW-Madison. And my question is, what role do solar panels and agrivoltaics play in low-income and developing communities?
Oh, solar and low-income and also in developing countries.
Yeah. Hi, Ethan. It's good to hear from you. There's a lot of interesting questions about this, right? It is, as Steve was mentioning, when we have solar panels, this is a way for farmers, in the case of agrivoltaics, to generate additional income through leasing with power companies. Certainly communities and community solar is an option in some communities that are looking for a way to generate some income security while generating local energy. Certainly in the developing world, there's a lot of interest in kind of leapfrogging in terms of growing their energy demand in the same way that they the way that cell phone revolution allowed for the businesses and economies of many countries to grow rapidly. We're seeing something similar in that you don't need a lot of background and expertise to get a few solar panels together and wire them up and generate some power. And next thing you know, you put some stuff together and you're able to do a lot more than you could before.
Yeah, all good points. Ethan, thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. Gene in Menominee, we'll go to you next. Hi, Gene.
Hi. Yes, we looked into putting solar panels up, and we did. And we looked at tracking, and from what we could see, it's problematic to have tracking in our winter climates. They tend to break, whereas we installed just a simple tilt on our panels so that in the wintertime, it's nearly vertical. In the summertime, it's almost flat. And that also puts the panels out of harm's way with the animals during the time when the grass is productive in the summertime. They're up high, whereas in the wintertime, when you don't have the animals out there, they're down low.
No. Comment on that, Steve?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Single-axis trackers have really become kind of the most common for the large utility scale. But there are moving parts, and moving parts break, and so there is more maintenance. But that's why at the large scale it kind of makes sense. You're going to have people out there checking on it, fixing, doing maintenance. For the small scale, that's a harder thing to manage. And so sometimes the fixed tilt is the better option. And certainly if you have the ability to manually tilt that so that it has a different angle in the summer and winter, you're getting some of the benefit, but without the extra moving parts.
Yeah, it makes sense. Gene, thank you for calling and letting us know how you're doing it. Dorothy in Nakusa, your turn. Hi, Dorothy.
Well, I have a question. We have a large solar farm near us, and from what I've heard, it has a life expectancy of like 25 to 30 years, and then then they move on. Are they going to keep moving on and just gobbling up more land to install more panels? Why have I not heard anything about reusing the same land and just replacing the panels?
Oh, I think that's being done, isn't it, Steve? Yeah.
Yep. Sometimes the panels are being replaced. And in fact, you know, what's really enabled this increase in the amount of solar arrays is the decreased cost and improved efficiency. From 2010 to 2020, the cost of large-scale solar decreased 82%. And that's why it's coming to Wisconsin, right? Solar used to exist in the Southwest. There's a lot more available energy, right? It's further south, and it's less cloudy. And so the potential to generate electricity is higher there. That's why it came to Wisconsin a little bit later, but it's growing really rapidly now. Though, if you look at the footprint, I saw from Renew Wisconsin an estimate that if we were to try to meet our current electricity demands all with solar, it would take about 250,000 acres, which is less than 2% of the agricultural lands that we have in the state.
And there is a very large farm. I think the largest farm, isn't it, Encore, that's coming in?
The recently approved from the Public Service Commission is the Vista Sands Solar Project. So this is a 9,500-acre agrivoltaic facility. This is across multiple farms through primarily the central sands region of Wisconsin. That one is expected to generate close to 1.3 gigawatts of electricity. So that's about 500 times larger than what we're talking about at our research site.
How many homes is that?
That's 200,000 homes.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, and that's in the process.
That's just been approved.
Yeah. So they're going to be going on that pretty quickly. Well, your research, you've just kind of been going on this a short time, right? Or how long is
project? We have one full field season under our belt. But we actually did this at a few other sites around the state. Up in New Lisbon, Black River Falls, and Middleton, we have sites because our site at Caganza just got installed this fall. And so we were kind of ready to go before the site was.
Yeah, it's the reality of construction, for sure.
And those towers, and they'll be going in. Do you have towers at the other sites too?
We did not put out towers at the other site.
So this will be really interesting then to see how this all...
This will be unique. It is, based on my analysis, I believe it will be the first of this type of tower measurement over a solar field in the entire U.S. and probably the second in the world. So it'll be a pretty unique measurement to be able to understand.
And how long will, how long before you get some findings that you're going to be really interested in?
Well, I'm excited about, as we get things going this winter into summer, I'd be very excited to see where we are about 6 months from now. And we'll start to see some of the impacts, being able to compare productivity. And of course, as we have another full season, we'll try to understand what's going on. But I'm really looking forward to it. We did some other fun projects. I know, as Steve mentioned, some of these other solar fields. It was not just research. We also had some opportunity to take students out to this field. I taught an atmospheric and oceanic sciences course at the site in Middleton, where we got the students to deploy some measurements in partnership with Madison Gas and Electric to look at microclimate impacts. And it's been really fun. These are also great learning opportunities for our students here at the university.
I would believe that, and I want to thank you both. We'll have to get you back here once you've got some data, say a year from now. We'll all sit down together and we'll do this again. Thank you both so much.
Fantastic.
Thank you, Larry. It'd be great to give an update.
Yep, love it.
Steve Lohide, hydrologist and professor of civil and environmental engineering at the UW, and Encore Desai, department chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison, our guest. Boy, interesting stuff going on, isn't there? Thanks so much for tuning in today. Got a great team, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnott, our producers, technical directors Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you so much for being with us. And tomorrow we'll be looking at books that our WPR staff are recommending. Thanks for being with us.